My name is Yana Owens, and I'm interviewing Richard B. Schneidl at his home in Charlotte, North Carolina, on August 15, 2011. To get us started, tell me a little bit about where you're from and how you got interested in architecture.
Well, I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. After the war, my brother and I both enrolled at State. He enrolled in chemical engineering and I enrolled in anthropology or something. And so about the first 6 months we decided, well, why don't we get into something that we could do together. And so we decided on architecture. For some reason.
Mm-hmm. Now that was still
It still interested us.
Right. Now that was when architecture was still in the School of Engineering, right?
At that time,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. That was Department of Architecture in the School of Engineering before Camp Hefner came,
right.
Of course.
And right.
So we did. It was, and I just can't remember really exactly
it just what seemed like the right
to
thing to do together,
at the time,
huh?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, how did you decide on State in the first place? Was there something about it that attracted you from just to whatever you were going to major in?
Well, we knew it was engineering. I mean, we didn't want to get into law, or that attracted both my brother and I, because
mm-hmm.
we got out of the service about the same time, within a month of each other.
Right.
So we decided on State because it seemed to offer more of what we were looking for at the time.
Now, what year did you start?
Started in 46.
46. And there was a circumstance that caused you not to graduate with your original class. Did you want to tell me about that?
Well, they had given me credit for being in the service for the physical education, PE. Requirement, and they had done that for 4 years, which we went 5 years in a four-year period. We went all summer and fall, winter, spring, just constant to graduate from a five-year course in 4 years. But my last report card, they had reduced my hours that they gave me for physical education from 48 hours of credit to 36, so I couldn't graduate
mm-hmm.
in 1950. So I went to work and took, over a period of 2 years, I took two correspondence courses to give me enough credits to where I graduated in 1952, but not with my classmates.
Right. Well, who were some of your classmates?
Oh, Charles Boney, Herb McKim, Frank Ballard,
Was A.C. Hall in your class?
Pardon?
A.C. Hall, was he in your class?
Hall?
Uh-huh. Or Charlie Sappenfield?
Sappenfield was, yes, Charlie.
And your brother, of course.
Oh, yes, my brother.
Who were some of the professors during this period?
Oh, me. I'll refer to this.
Okay, a list that we made of professors.
Willie Baumgartner, Jim Fitzgibbons, George Matsumoto, Ed Wall, Matthew Nowitzki was my senior year professor. Of course, there was Henry Kampfner. Let's see, Catalano was there. I don't remember if I'm in Milton Small and Caminas.
What was Willie Bumgarner like?
I was just going to say he was a German. And I remember my brother and I were both in his class at the same time. And my brother was a little overweight, and I'm about the build I am now.
Mm-hmm.
They call on the roll. And Willie would say, Sneedle thick and Sneedle thin. He would call us thick and thin. But that's all I remember.
How about Nowitzki? Nowitzki.
Nowitzki.
My mouth didn't work on that
Nowitzki.
One too well. How about, what was he like as a teacher?
Oh, he was great. My memory's not that good anymore, but he was just a very interesting person. I've got a stack of pictures back there of his works and everything, and he was an excellent teacher, fifth year, and unfortunately he was killed in a plane accident in Egypt. He had gone to, where was it? India, I guess. He was designing the capital city of Punjab, something I believe like that. He was on his way back from a trip over there and the plane crashed in Egypt. And
what was the students' reaction to that?
Well, we all went back to state and memorial for him.
Mm-hmm.
From all over, I mean students, his students from all over, living all over.
Right.
We all went back to state for his memorial.
It was a pretty sad time then, wasn't it?
Yeah, very, very much so.
Well, let me ask you this. In addition to the faculty, there was a lot of visiting crits. And I know one in particular caught your attention. Would you like to tell me about that one particular crit? The visiting crits? Frank Lloyd Wright?
Oh my goodness, yes. he was invited to state. Kampfner got him to come to talk to the graduating class. We had a session over Kampfner's house, and of course, we were all sitting on the floor, and he was sitting up in this chair, and we all just agog. And he gave a public talk in Reynolds Coliseum, I believe it was. I believe it was built in.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was quite a to-do for us, well, in fact, for the people of Raleigh to have such a famous person. I guess I told you before maybe the thing, I don't know why, but the most thing I remember the most about this speech that he had given, public speech, was he was talking about the masses, and he said, take the M off of mass and put it on the, and what do you have?
A bit caustic remark, huh? That's good.
Yeah.
Well, we're
I guess because, you know, he didn't believe in the style. and people went for a style mm-hmm. of architecture and other things, and I guess that's the reason he moved the M over.
Yep. Did you while you were in school and you were influenced by Camp Hefner's theory and some of these other people, did you start designing modern type buildings at that end while you were in school, or were you still designing more traditional kinds of things?
Never designed traditional.
Even in school?
No.
Where did that inspiration come from?
Well, I don't really remember exactly, but it's like I was saying, this style, you know, people just fell for that, and Frank Lloyd didn't believe in there was any particular style. You were doing it individually and for the requirements of the owner and for your interpretation of them. So each building was unique. It didn't have a style.
Mm-hmm.
So that freed you from being tied down to letting style dictate design, and it should where it should not. So you were free to express things the way that they should be, not to satisfy a style.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was that philosophy part of your training in school? In other words, when you finished at State, what theory and what direction were you headed in at that time?
Well, you just designed to satisfy owners' requirements. I don't know that I can't give a real explanation except just to our interpretation to satisfy the client
mm-hmm.
needs. And through design, and
so that whenever the clients would talk to you, that this is you would hear what they were saying, and then you would kind of think about it and then draw a design that they liked,
right?
And
yes.
It was in the modernist, definitely non-traditional style for that
time.
Yeah,
not copying anybody, Mies van der Rohe or Saarinen or anybody. I mean, you do what your interpretation.
Right.
Later on, when doing residential architecture, I would have the owners to write out a program, so it really got them to thinking deeply into the way that they lived, and so that I can interpret it more fully. And it was easier to satisfy their needs when they had thought about things and put it in writing.
Right. Well, in addition to working a few months with Willie Bumgarner, you went after you graduated, you went to work for Leslie Boney Sr. in Wilmington.
Yes.
Tell me about that time.
Well, that was interesting. I worked there for two to three years. I forgot what, but it was interesting. Leslie Sr. was the father,
mm-hmm.
and Leslie Jr. was the older son, so he really ran the office. And Charlie and I did all of the design work, and
That's Charles Boney, Charlie Boney.
Charlie Boney, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Who was the younger son. Mm-hmm. It was Leslie and Bill and Charlie. But all of them were architects, so. And worked 12-hour days.
Do you remember some of the projects you worked on?
We did work all over the East, really. It's just I remember a church down at Wrightsville Beach that I did most of the design on it. And little church on the boardwalk, I believe it was called.
Mm-hmm.
That was a very small project, right. Compared to other big college projects and all that we had, because they were noted for their school work.
The Boneys were noted for their school work.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. We have the Leslie Senior and Junior drawings in the archive at Special Collections. It starts in 1901 and goes to 1988.
Yeah.
So you were there in the...
I guess it was on the computer where I got that list.
Right, right.
Goodness sakes.
That's something, and that's a long span.
Ooh,
and still
boy.
Going strong.
Mm-mm-mm.
In July of 1953, you and your brother set up your practice, Schneedle and Schneedle. And the curious fact to me is that you set up your practice in Reidsville, North Carolina, which at the time had a population of about 12,000 people and was mostly the center of commerce and trade was tobacco.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't sound like the place where two up-and-coming modernist designers would land. What was the decision behind staying in Reidsville?
Well, my brother had an office he was running for an architect, can't think of his name now, in Greensboro. So he was working for this architect.
Was it Lowenstein?
It could have been Lowenstein.
Okay.
Yeah. So he decided to go out on his own, and so he called me to come up, and because he had gotten some school work, and he had more than he could handle, so he wanted me to come up and join him. So I did. I guess it was 1953. So. We did that for a little over 10 years, about 11 years. We
right.
had our firm up there.
Is this about when you met Lewis Clark?
Yes. Uh huh.
And you started picking up some clients for their residences, and again we think. Why were they building in Reidsville? We've got some pretty remarkable examples of your work there. The first one that comes to mind is the Foyle residence. Do you remember the Foyle residence?
Foyle?
Uh-huh.
Yes, vaguely. Like I say, my memory is not what it once was.
This is a long time
ago. The name,
ago.
Yes, I know, but...
It was the one where you decided with Lewis Clark that that something needed to be done beside the carport because the view from the dining room was into the carport.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right. Okay.
And Les Lasky built a mural.
Right. Lewis suggested doing movable panels of all of these different colors, but
mm-hmm.
where you could change the... Change the look
mm-hmm.
Whenever you decided
right.
you'd just like to try something. And you'd seen the other one for so long, but so he suggested movable panel mural
mm-hmm.
out on the wall that faced the dining room. So.
Did you like what they came up with?
Very much.
I understand that Lasky painted that with auto paints so it could be cleaned and weatherproofed. Do you know if it's still in existence?
No, I do not. I sure do not.
Okay, that was in 52 or 53, so that was a pretty early design. In 57, you did the T.E. Forbes doctor's office in Reidsville. And the interesting thing about that is that you used skylights instead of windows in the exam rooms, and the design was nominated for an NCAIA Honor Award. What was happening with skylights at that time? This is a new application.
Well, they had come up with a very good skylight. It was not complicated. I mean, you buy it all in one piece, you build a curb, set it on. So it was very easy to penetrate the roof and get natural light into all the rooms that you wanted. And of course you want privacy in an examining mm-hmm. room, so this did both, really. It gave you privacy, and plus you got
some daylight in there.
Natural light.
That was pretty inventive at the time to use those. Yeah. Was it because they had changed to a plastic type material for the skylights?
Yes, I guess it was. They had the dome skylight of plastic, and a very, very simple framework to connect to a curb that penetrates the roof. And it was very easy to install because
mm-hmm.
they had done such a good job of doing the designing the skylights.
So it's a situation of materials catching up with the ideas of the architects at that time, right? Because I get the feeling that you guys pushed the envelope on what different materials could do to get your designs like they are. So I start seeing this plastic introduction starts getting a little interesting there. Do you remember anything about the Herbert Mace House in Reidsville?
Herbert Mace, yes. I believe he was a jeweler, but we designed that house, and Lewis Clark was our landscape architect.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught. I guess that's one of the things that I remember. There were maybe two things I remember from Lewis Clark, but there should have been a million. But in locating a fireplace, outdoor fireplace, where you'd go out and cook, the logic was so marvelous that you want it to be a destination. You don't want to fall out of the house right into a fireplace outdoor. Mm-hmm. You want to change the environment completely, so you want to separate from the house. So it was to be a destination, not just something to happen to fall out of the house into.
Right.
But you had to prepare to go down that far.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing on that house, I don't know whether it was Mace House or some other house, but his theory was that the closer you got to the house, the more manicured the landscaping became. which just makes all kind of sense, you know.
Yeah.
So the logic of these two things are just marvelous, and that's all my mind will let me remember.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's try another one. We're doing pretty good here. The Henry Pace House in Leakesville, North Carolina, probably about 1956 or 57. Do you remember anything about the Pace House?
Well, I know that I've got the drawings that I'm giving to Todd.
Right.
It's got Lewis Clark's drawings.
No kidding.
With it.
How nice.
So, I can't remember the floor plan or the setting right now, but I do know that we've got the drawings of it, including Lewis Clark.
That is great. That is great. Okay, this next one is just a remarkable use of cast concrete. It's the Holy Infant Catholic Church in Reidsville, and it was dedicated in 1962. Tell me about how you came up with the concept for that church.
Well, the concept was an opening flower where the petals separated, you know, and it gave you a definite shape, you know, of opening in walls. Now that concept, I'll admit, was my brother's concept, but I carried it through in working in detailed working drawings, and added my touch to it too. But it was just a unique concept to put a structure to, really. The walls became load-bearing with the design of the spread support that held the roof, concrete beam. And so the petals of the open flower set the rhythm of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an exposed structure. And
by exposed, what do you mean, exposed structure?
Well, it didn't have a drop ceiling to hide all of that. We expressed
the underside of the
structure.
Right.
Yeah, the structure was part of the interior design, really. So, let's see.
Now that one was featured in Progressive Architecture magazine.
Yes.
So that's quite one of your. That's one of my favorites of your work. Now there was an ice cream parlor that. That I think it was the ice cream parlor or a drugstore that you built, you designed for Reidsville, that has these kind of very delicate
Guilford Dairy Bars.
Guilford Dairy Bar, right? Tell me about those the supports that you designed for that one.
Well, primarily it was the canopy for people to walk in inclement weather.
Mm-hmm.
It went out to the, extended out to the parking lot where they could come in, and it was a single post with cantilevered spread beams from one post. We had four cantilevered
canopies
structures, and
right.
Then that carried the flat roof.
Right. Very, very nice design. Very nice design. Let's see. And then how about the Henry and Hazel Nave residence in Southern Pines? That was about 1966.
What was the name?
The Nave residence.
Oh, Nave. Yeah, Henry Nave. My memory is just not...
that's good. Well, but I think we have some pictures of that one.
Whether it's medicine or old age or both or something else.
There's just a lot in your head to keep straight. Around 68, you and your brother split, and you went to work with, or you partnered with Dick Mitchell, Tommy Hayes, and Calvin Howell at Hayes Howell in Southern Pines. Tell me about those guys. Tell me, they're interesting characters to me.
Well, Tom Hayes was president, and he originated the firm. Calvin Howell was more of the business person. Dick Mitchell was very good at doing working drawings, the details, so forth. And I did the design work for him. I was vice president of design for the firm. And so I was there for 20 years doing that.
Do you know how many schools you designed while you were there?
Oh, heavens no. Golly, Pete. Because we were pretty well known for our school work.
What was special about your designs for the schools?
Just efficient. Just our knowledge of relationship of spaces to with the students. Where it the knowledge of that made it more simple for the students.
Do you recall one that you especially liked?
Goodness, well, I guess really the Reidsville Senior High School.
The Reidsville Senior High School?
Not Reidsville, Southern Pines.
Oh, Southern
Excuse
Pines.
Excuse me. Heck, going. At the time, they were experimenting in education, the way they taught. It was quite a different concept. So it was a new experience for us to interpret and design the school with this concept.
Now this is about
it was easy to convert back to a typical school structure.
Mm-hmm. This was about the time of the Federal Model Schools program. A lot of federal money was coming into the South to build schools that had multi-purpose rooms or libraries that had more activities than books going on. So I think you guys were riding on that particular input at that time. This change, when you say change in the teaching method, it was drastic changes going on. So the building had to change a little bit as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, where the money came from, it wasn't, that was Calvin Howell's.
Right.
yeah, that was his worry.
Right.
I just did the school and interpreting the needs and the new way of going about teaching that they were experimenting with. But it would still convert back to a standard.
Well, in the 1980s, I'm not sure exactly what year, but you left Hayes Howell, and what did you do next?
I left there in 84. Well, we were, when I was at Hayes Hall, we were trying to get a job down on Bald Head Island that redoing the clubhouse and all kind of different things. I went down there to talk to the owner of the island, Mitchell.
Who was that?
That was Kent Mitchell and his brother, and of course his father bought the island, but in the process I became interested in going to work for the island, doing, well, 50% of my time I would be doing work for them, and that would leave me 50% of my time to do private work, which was interesting because it was different.
Get a little tired living of building schools,
island.
Right?
Yeah, out of schools. During the years, my interest really was working with owners in doing residential work. It just had more character to them. It was low key as far as stress. Didn't have anybody working for me or anything at the time. So I decided to leave Hayes Howell and go down there and work on my own.
Now you actually moved to Bald Head Island.
Moved to Bald Head.
Moved the family and everybody.
Well, the family was pretty much in school then.
Right.
College. So. Mm-hmm. It was quite an experience. Riding carts to work every day. No cars. sort of set the tone for everything.
Right.
Sort of. Low-key, slow.
Now, in starting to design, and I think you designed 30 or 40 houses down at Bald Head Island.
Well, at least, yeah.
Whenever you started looking at how you were going to approach these, like their facial look to them, you went up and down the coast doing something, searching for something that you call coastal vernacular. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Well, the owner wanted to keep sort of a quaintness to the island, so he wanted to keep a coastal, the old coastal vernacular for the island. So I went up and down the whole coast of North Carolina and taking photographs and things that gave you that feeling that it was of that vernacular. And so you had to incorporate them into your residences.
Mm-hmm.
Also the town hall that I did, I mean, it had to be of that character. So it was interesting.
What was something that was typical of coastal vernacular? What kind of a little detail or something would be typical?
Well, the cedar shakes was one, siding, plus other detail work with the cedar shakes. Overhangs. They did have overhangs then, not this developers' roofs.
Mm-hmm.
And roofs were important. And just little details of finishing off the cedar shakes. That type of thing is what created it.
Let's see here. We got the Marine Science Center. You designed the Marine Science Center?
Yes, that was, with Hayes Howell then. We designed the Marine Science Facility, which was it was for the public's use, where we had big water tanks for seawater and had sharks and all of this kind of thing that you normally see in an aquarium.
And that's located, where is that located?
That's out from Moorhead City. There's a
Pine Knoll Shores?
String of a peninsular type thing.
Oh, I see. Emerald Isle?
Yeah, I think
out
maybe
that
so.
Way.
Yeah.
How about Indigo Village? What? Tell me about Indigo Village.
That was Indigo Village was done right from the marina, the on the mainland, where the boats, the ferries from Bald Head Island would come and dock to pick up passengers, let them off, and so forth. So it was the it was part of this the whole Bald Head Island type concept, and it was single family, and well, I guess they were somewhat condominiums. So we laid that out and designed the coastal vernacular residences or condos.
Very attractive. Now, I'm not sure how to pronounce this next name. It's Barica? Barica?
Barica.
Barica House? Where is that located?
It's on Bald Head Island. It's a house that I designed for myself, and but they came along and like saw the drawings that I had, and with the gazebo out front towards the ocean, where they could sit out there and enjoy the breeze and the views, and so that was just pretty much a.
But you had designed that for your own use.
Yeah, but I didn't build it for me.
How about the Wesley House?
Wesley was built on the main dune down at Bald Head. I designed it so the roof slope pretty much matched the slope of the dune, so it wouldn't fight with the dune for attention or anything, but so it blended in as much as possible to with the environment. But it still faced up the ocean, of course, because of the great view it had from up there. So it was quite nice.
The nickname on that one is the Dune House, right?
Uh-huh.
That's its nickname, is the Dune House.
Yeah.
How about the Coe House? Do you remember the Coe House, C-O-E, Coe House?
Coe House, yeah. That was done over at Country Club of North Carolina, I believe it was.
Okay.
Yeah. They had a nice site overlooking a little pond in the golf course at CCNC. Most of those houses we'd have to really, a structural engineer would have to come in because it was all sandy soil, and do some work on each site really to firm up underneath where the house was going. And that was one of them that we had to work on.
Right.
On the site to get it to support a house, really.
Right.
And
right.
So.
Do you remember what street it's on?
It's, golly Pete, it's on.
Or what hole it's off of?
I got some drawings
okay.
back there.
We'll get that, okay.
Oh dear.
Do you have any advice for today's young architects?
Oh boy. I've been out of it so long,
just tell them to hang in there, right?
Yeah, hang in there for right now.
Did you have any particular way that you approached a client when you had that first meeting with a client? Was there some strategy that you had that you brought to the table?
Well,
you already mentioned that you had them write their program. So, did you have questions that you asked them to help them develop their program?
Oh yes. I just tried to get them involved, and where it really became part of them, the way they lived. Their living habits, you know. If they had coffee in the bedroom, well, I'd give them a place to make coffee, you know, or something like that. But it was done for them, and it should support the way that they are used to living, not give them something that I think is, something they ought to have. It just, you just don't force it down them.
That sounds like good advice. Listen to the clients and see what they want to have, and just guide the project along.
Yeah.
Good advice, I think. What's the one important thing to know about Dick Schneedel?
Goodness sakes alive, one important. Golly Pete, I don't know. That's like trying to fill out that fellowship thing. I can't think of anything.
Okay. Well, those are all the questions I have for today. Do you have anything you'd like to add? I do have one other question. Go ahead. I remembered another one.
So. Form follows function.
Form follows function.
Yeah.
That's the one.
That's it.
I meant to ask you this. When you were a practicing architect, what were the reasons why you hired a landscape architect? What would be some reasons why?
Well, to enhance the property, make it more appealing, just all kind of reasons. But it's certainly worth worthwhile. And you learn from, like I learned from Lewis Clark, so many things I couldn't even think of them except this, those that I mentioned.
Right.
The logic that he used just makes all sense in the world. To making a place enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. So. And that's the landscape architects do that then, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
They're part of the team.
Some years ago, USA Today asked readers to write a memoir in 6 words or less. And a Richard Schneedle posted this. He said, "Many risky mistakes, very few regrets." Was that you?
Don't
remember that one.
Oh, Lord. That sounds like.
That sounds like you?
Yeah.
Well, that's what we'll leave it at. You take risk and just keep bouncing right back, huh?
Yeah. Well, I can't.
That's okay.
I can't add to that.
Well, we'll just end with that then.
All right. Thank you
very much for answering my questions today.
Yes, ma'am. I hope I did all right.
You did fine.
With such a poor memory.
You did great. Thank you.